This is the Commercial Property Show, Australia, show number 67.
We just recently refinanced the whole thing and we pulled out close to $1 million.
Hey, commercial property community, thank you so much for joining me. My name is Andrew Bean. Welcome to the Commercial Property Show, the biggest, the baddest, and the best commercial property podcast in Australia. Today, we have an absolute ripper episode for you, as always, and here it is. Today, I'm interviewing Tim Hashke, a longtime listener of the show and an investor that has managed to build up a $10 million portfolio in 3 years. That is absolutely awesome. And he explains how he's taken full advantage, basically giving himself an unfair advantage because of what he does for work. And he's used that as a value add on these properties. Super interesting, very simple stuff, but it really does show that you can use commercial property to build massive portfolios in a very short period of time if you have the right plan. And if you are getting value out of this podcast, please consider subscribing, rate the podcast. It really does help me out and let me know that you guys are enjoying it. If you want to take your real estate investing to the next level, I have just started a brand new YouTube channel where I'll be sharing everything I know about investing in real estate. I'll be sharing beginner tips all the way up to advanced investing strategies to help you build that cash flowing real estate portfolio you're looking for. And you'll get a first-hand look at all of my properties and everything I'm buying in future. So if you want to check it out, type my name, Andrew Bean, into Google or YouTube, or you can click the link in the show notes. My next guest is a longtime listener, and he has built up a pretty impressive portfolio over a short period of time. It's Tim Hashke. How are you doing? Oh, my God, I did it again.
You gotta leave that one in.
Tim Hashke. Oh my God. We just got his name wrong and I thought it was Hashke and we just did a whole thing to redo it and it's actually Hashke. Well, how are you anyway?
Very good. Very excited to be here, Andrew.
I'm very excited to have you here, mate. You've been a long time listener. I've seen your name pop up on my phone quite a few times. You know, it's awesome. So tell me a little bit about your background, what you actually do on your day-to-day basis.
Yeah, for sure. Born in Germany, I came over to Australia 10 years ago. Back then, I came over with my best friend, Felix. At the start, we just came over to backpack. We thought we're just going to stick around for 6 months, slid into a job, which is our profession nowadays, and just stayed. Yeah, nowadays, I got my citizenship and absolutely loving Australia.
Awesome, eh? Just sprechen der Deutsch. I actually lived in Germany for 6 months in an industrial town called Mannheim. I was playing semi-professional baseball there in the Bundesliga there. I was getting paid to play and go over there and all that kind of stuff. So it was very, very fun.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah. Whereabouts were you in Germany?
I'm from the west, from near Cologne. The city's called Aachen. You probably wouldn't know it, but it's right on the border to the Netherlands and Belgium.
You really got to dig deep in the back of your throat to say that Aachen, like it's really like that. Like, how do you spell that?
It's A-A-C-H-E-N.
Yeah, wow. Wow. I love that. I love that. So are you a Weizen beer drinker?
Yeah. Back in the days, for sure. Had plenty of those. Plenty of those. Yeah. It's good German.
Good stuff. So, mate, like, how did you get into investing in real estate?
Yeah, okay. It started, maybe I'll tell you first how I got into business over here. So slid into a job, which is building shelving and pallet racking, mm-hmm. which is kind of industrial, you know. We built a company around that. Now the company is 8.5 years old. We have close to or around 200 employees, and we do large industrial sheds for big logistics companies, for food retailers, American sportswear brands. And that has been pretty good, which gave us the firepower to get started in real estate, really.
That's awesome. And so you started as like an employee, and then you opened your own pallet racking, like mezzanine kind of warehousey kind of business.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah. We worked for this old Russian dude who did Target refurbishments. And then at the start, we were young and naive. He told us he could sponsor us. So we followed him around. So we worked for him in Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, in all the small towns in between, Wangaratta and Wagga Wagga and so on. Just followed him around and really learned the craft. And he got older and older. So he must be now 75 or so. He's really old now. Yeah, it was less and less. He took less and less jobs. He was less on site. We got to know the guys from Target. Eventually, they asked us to call the job, and then we kicked it off.
And what happened to Felix, your mate who you came over with?
Yeah, still. So we're best friends now since 22 years.
Wow.
Met a long time ago. Yeah, still best friends. He's my business partner. He's my partner in investing. And we're best friends. Yeah, it's pretty great.
That's fantastic. So obviously he's very involved in the real estate as well.
He is. Yeah, I'm probably more the driver of that, but he's pretty engaged, and we're investing together.
That's like, fantastic, mate.
I can tell you how this all started. Maybe it started similar for you. So I was on a job in Melbourne where we just assembled pallet racking frames. We were listening, or I was listening to podcasts, and by chance, it was Bigger Pockets. Bigger Pockets podcast.
Yes. Bigger Pockets is a sick podcast.
Unreal. And then one episode sounded quite interesting. And it was just crazy. One after the next, they were talking about financial freedom. These young guys who had enough money to start trading time for money. And that was probably my rich dad, poor dad moment. And first I thought that must be a scam. You know, I didn't have any exposure to this. That was, by the way, 2020. So pretty much 4 years ago now. And then I was super excited, ran home, told my partner Jess about it. And I thought, wow, this is really out there. And from then on, it was just listening nonstop every day, 2-3 hours listening to podcasts and then figuring out how we get started.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Shout out to Brandon Turner, David Green from the Bigger Pockets podcast. Yeah, definitely owe a lot of my success to that podcast as well. It's an American podcast, so it might not be your flavor, but damn, that's got some good content. They've done like over 500 or 600 or 800 episodes or something. Unbelievable.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think some of the concepts translatable, and you know, they do a lot of creative stuff, and definitely gets your mind working. It's pretty good. And I could hear actually when I started listening to your stuff, there's a bit of influence there.
Yeah.
Couple of quotes.
There is. I modeled some of what Brandon Turner is pretty much one of my like digital mentors. I definitely like his philosophies and everything. And it's just a unbelievable podcast. Definitely go check it out. So mate, in terms of like your first steps into real estate, did you go for residential first or did you go straight into commercial?
Yeah, so we actually bought the first two at the same time. So it was a residential and a commercial. Back then it was more me being interested into real estate, a little bit less Felix. And then I lined up the first residential, went with a buyer's agent, unfortunately bought in Melbourne, but that's okay. Also, at the same time, we did the same process with a commercial buyer's agent. And we did that because at the time I had the permanent residency, Felix didn't. So I know there are some rules that if we have a trust, 50% of that needs to be Australian resident, so we don't get hit with this big tax because it's a foreign trust, you know? So therefore, that's how we ended up then in commercial, started doing a lot of research about it, and it just sounded good to be true, huh?
Yeah, I guess like you were also very exposed to it because of the work that you did as well. Like how early on was this while you were still doing that job?
Yeah. So I'm actually still in the job, but that's basically 4 years ago now or 3 years ago. And you're right, we always felt comfortable with industrial sheds or warehouses, however you want to call them, and probably felt more comfortable with it than actually with residential.
Yep. And so just so we're fully clear, did you end up starting a new business, or did you take over that business? Now it's your business.
Yeah, now so we started the business together. So Felix and me, and it was just a fresh business.
It was a similar business to the one you were working at with your old employer.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. And so in terms of like using what you know with your actual business, how do you do that on a day-to-day basis? Like you've got a really, really big advantage than most people with the work that you do.
Good point. So first we kicked it off. We got comfortable with it. We used the buyer's agent just to buy set and forget properties. But then pretty quickly, we needed an owner-occupier for our construction company. And then we said, we buy it, we put the mezzanine in. And then this whole thinking started of the value add, because we knew all the suppliers, we knew how to apply for the permits, and it was actually pretty easy. The second property then, that was our warehouse in Clayton in Melbourne again, but it's probably our best performer at the moment in the portfolio. You know? So if I can give you some figures around the value add with the mezzanine, if you want.
Yeah, so what year was this? What year did you start?
Yeah, so in April, it's 3 years of investing. So started 2021.
Yeah, wow.
April 2021 was the first one. Yeah.
So not long at all. And you kind of stumbled into this. If I add a mezzanine, that's adding net lettable area, and then that's more income, and then that's more value.
Exactly. Yeah. And I listen to Bigger Pockets. I listen to guys like you. I know you were talking a lot about value add, and then just this whole thing developed. Because you can't go wrong with adding net lettable area. You always get it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So on that first property, yeah, go through some numbers if you want to. This is only 3 years ago, so it's very, very fresh. Like purchase price, then like increasing how much income you increased it by, and then what was it valued at later on?
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so we bought it in September 21 for $525. It was just a strata unit, like an industrial unit, 145 square meters, just an empty box, nothing in there. We added a mezzanine of 92 square meters, which we used then as our own owner-occupier. And just recently, I got it revalued, and it valued at $975.
So you almost added more than half the area.
Yes, correct.
That's awesome. And so like this wasn't like a $2 million, $5 million, $10 million property off the bat. It was a reasonably affordable property for everyone.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at our portfolio now, there's a lot of properties under a mill. It's probably not ideal. I think maybe in a few years we look back and we're going to say, why did we buy all these little shoeboxes? But for now, stepping stones, I think it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, property it's a property ladder. So you do have to start somewhere, and your ladder may be massive and you've got to start at that first rung. So starting at $500,000 warehouse, very, very affordable. But the key was that you have a way to add value to it. It's not just set and forget forever. Did you actively know that that was possible when you bought it, like adding in a mezzanine? Was that always part of the plan? Did the buyer's agency like show that to you and help you with that?
I'm pretty sure it came from podcasts. You know, definitely there was the idea there. And then there was the discussion, hey, we do a mezzanine. We definitely need a permit. Otherwise, it doesn't add value. So when we bought it already, we knew that this is the play. Actually, this is now the second time we refinance the property. So pretty early, probably after 6 months after we had it, we pulled money out and bought the next one.
So you've recycled money straight away, pretty much after 12 months.
Correct. And then after 6 months,
6 months. So did you recycle all of your cash out of that property?
Yes, at the time we did. Yes, we did.
So now you have an infinite return on the property because you have none of your own money into it.
Correct.
So that's like rich dad, poor dad, like, tick there. That's exactly what you want to do. Infinite returns all day, baby.
That's it.
Good stuff. So what were the challenges that you found doing that? Was there anything that really came up with that particular for the first purchase?
Not really. I think it was pretty smooth sailing. No holdups. The works back then, the mezzanine, I did all myself. It was a pretty cheap value add. Yeah, no issues with it. We're actually still in this warehouse right now.
Yeah,
we're going to move pretty soon. And that's the next one. It's a warehouse in Port Melbourne where we do exactly the same thing.
And did you also pay your company to put it in as well? So you made money on the mezzanine as well, right?
Look, so the materials obviously run through the construction company. I guess it's a little bit left pocket, right pocket, you know. So
And then you also paid yourself as well, right? Surely.
Yeah, no, I think it was a weekend. I think there was on the house.
Okay, but don't worry. No one from the tax department listens to this podcast anyway. You'll be right.
You never know.
So after you pulled out basically what? All your money out of the first one, then you bought the second one. So tell me about the second property that you bought.
Actually, the first one was with a buyer's agent on the Sunshine Coast. There was just a set and forget, 6%. You know, back then the interest rates were very low. Then the second one was the one in Clayton, which was the owner-occupier. Third one and the fourth one was then again with a buyer's agent, just again set and forget. I think the idea was there, we probably could have gone a little bit more aggressive, but back then we were a little bit more conscious of the cash flow and wanted to make sure that the portfolio carries itself or runs positive, you know. So therefore we tried to maintain it a little bit of in regards to value add and good cash flow properties. I mean, that was back then. You know, the cash flow nowadays is not that good right now.
Yeah, yeah. So you bought three properties in really quick succession after the first one. Did all of them have that value, same value add potential?
Yeah, so the three we bought with a buyer's agent, they didn't have any value add potential. But then the three we bought after that, they were all units where we added the mezzanine, where we did exactly that play. So we did it now four times. And the fifth time is just on the way, which is our new Port Melbourne.
So you bought one with the buyer's agency that had the mezzanine, and then you bought another three that didn't have the potential for mezzanine. Is that right?
Okay. So now it's a little bit complicated. Okay, first one was with the buyer's agent.
Yeah.
Second one, we bought ourselves. We added the mezzanine.
Okay. Yeah.
Then we're after that, number three and four with the buyer's agent. And then after that, there were a couple we just bought without the buyer's agent where we just looked at the numbers and we knew the value.
Yeah, okay. So that's where I got confused because you did buyer's agent, no buyer's agent, buyer's agent, buyer's. Yeah, okay. Yeah, cool. Yeah. Awesome. So why did you keep going back to the buyer's agent if they weren't getting as good a property with you that could add huge value?
I think it was just conservative because I guess the cash flow numbers, they look pretty good. So for example, our loans back then, I had something fixed, which was 2.75%, you know, and then we got a 6% yield, and that was just sitting in the portfolio. And I thought, actually, at the start, I thought this is way too easy. I said to Felix, hey, I think we only need 2 years, then we're done here. It's crazy. I couldn't believe it. But obviously, then we started investing in a time where it was, the interest rate extremely low.
So how many properties do we have now?
Okay, so on Friday, number 10 is settling.
Oh, okay. So we got another property settling this Friday. So after this goes Friday out, you will have already settled that property. And on average, what's the value of each property?
If I look at my spreadsheet, we have four properties sitting at $1 million. And then there are a couple of them which sit just below. We got 875, 700, 700, 800. So everything is sitting between 700 and $1 million, and the new purchase is a little bit higher, which is 1.75.
Awesome. And so what's the total portfolio value go to on this Friday or after this gets published?
We're going to hit the eight figures, which is quite exciting.
Awesome. Pretty good. That's fantastic. Great work. That's so cool. So how are you continuing to fund these? Obviously, the business must be doing very, very well.
Yep.
They're obviously, they can't just be set and forget. There must be some very, very good value adds on the 6, 7, 8 properties before this to be able to keep this portfolio rocking and rolling.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So one thing, you said it rightly, the business is doing well. We are living pretty frugal, saving our money. So, and the good thing there is we're investing together. You know, so we throw our money together, which makes it a little bit easier. And the other thing is now slowly the portfolio doesn't need any money anymore. So I feel like now we just recently we refinanced the whole thing and we pulled out close to $1 million. So
yeah,
this is
right.
Then what's going to fund the next purchases, a couple of mezzanines, and then hopefully we go again.
Gotta love those mezzanines, baby. Now that you're investing with equity, you're obviously at 100% finance for properties going forward. So there has to be some way that you're either adding value to this to increase the income, to make it worthwhile to get it to cash flow, or there has to be some kind of pay down strategy. And I'd say it's probably the adding value seems to be what you're good at. So is this the play? It's like you buy 100% finance, then you increase the net lettable area, and then you're getting that income up, the value up, and then...
Yeah, you get the value up, you also get the rent up, which is good, but you're right. Eventually, we got to find a balance there. So I think we can't do value add forever. I think then we probably need to put a couple of really good cash flow properties
into Don't say that. You can do value add forever, baby. Don't worry about that. You can always do forever. Just keep that value add going, because the value add is where, like, you can buy with 100% finance, but if you're creating $1 million every time, that's very, very easy to continue doing.
It's true.
So in terms of like structuring, how are you structuring this with Felix? Is this in a unit trust or a discretionary trust? You're not obviously related.
Yeah. So it's now slowly fairly complicated. So our accountant has this mind map up with all the different companies. So we have a couple of trusts together. We have a couple of companies together. So it is quite complicated, but obviously, I mean, you know, the principle is to shelter each property for risk mitigation. Yeah, so there's a lot of trusts.
So is it a unit trust or a discretionary trust that you're using?
Unit trust, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And so can you just explain to the listeners the difference between a discretionary trust and a unit trust?
I think there you need to help me a little bit. I think you can probably give me a better explanation.
All right, no worries. So a unit trust, you have a specific amount of units that Tim owns and Felix owns. I'd imagine that's 50-50, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So that means that you could sell units, you could give some to someone else, or, you know, whatever you want to do. Much more difficult to like get out of the trust or like move funds around. You only get access to the amount of revenue according to how many units in the trust that you own. With a discretionary trust, it's also known as a family trust. That means you can move the revenue around to anyone in your family, present or in the future, without any tax implications. And you actually can move the revenue around to make it your family more tax efficient. So if your wife doesn't work and you are obviously earning good money in your business and your real estate, then you could move funds to her and she could take that revenue theoretically like that. But realistically, it's still going to your bank account and you can still use the funds after the fact.
Makes sense.
Yeah, that's how it works.
So do you think you need a disclaimer after that? Or?
That's not financial advice. That's just our experience. Talk to your accountant, people. So, in terms of like size of like asset that you're buying into now, how has that changed?
Yeah. So we bought a lot of properties around the 500,000, 600,000, 700,000. Now for the first time, we buy a little bit more expensive property, which I guess it's the aim eventually to buy larger assets instead of all the small assets. Someone has to manage them. So ideally, the goal is now to buy better value assets. Yeah.
So, okay. And so this is a question that I'm sure will come up with the listeners. So it's great saying we can buy a property, a warehouse that doesn't have a mezzanine, but we've got a tenant. So what's the strategy there? Do you tell the tenant, hey, I'm going to put this mezzanine in your business. You just need to stop working for a week and I'll chuck it in and you got next extra net lettable area. But then I'm going to charge you more rent for it as well. Like this is a difficult part of doing what you're doing is that you might be in the middle of a longer lease and you can't really like chuck in a mezzanine and say to them, hey, now you owe me more money. You have to wait till the lease to really ends, or if it's on a month-to-month basis to do it. What's the strategy that you've been implementing there?
Yeah, totally agree. So far, we bought the units vacant where we did the mezzanines. Obviously, there's a bit of a risk there too. I mean, one thing is you need to pay the GST and the other thing is how quickly do you get rented. So far, so good. We had one property which was vacant for a longer period. But yes, just need to work that into the numbers to allow at least 6 months of vacancy. Usually it's not that long, but it obviously depends on the area where you purchase.
Yeah, okay. So are you putting together a new trust per property or are you grouping them together?
Yeah, so we had a couple of them grouped at the start, but now going forward, I think the idea is to have one trust.
Okay. So now, because you're buying vacant property, it triggers GST. It's not a going concern. So that means that you'll have to pay GST up front. But in the first BAS statement, you can actually get that GST back. It is annoying, but it's not like you lose that money. It is recoverable.
Correct. Yeah. Spot on. I mean, it took probably less than 3 months and we had the money back.
Yeah, perfect.
Awesome. Just an inconvenience.
Yeah. And so I do recognize that you also sound like you're reasonably heavily Melbourne based. You actually are in Melbourne, are you?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. So our headquarters are here in Melbourne. We recently, or a year ago, we spread out in Australia too. So we have now a branch in Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth, which is good, which means so now we have another property under contract, which is in Brisbane. So now the whole value add, we want to start in the other cities. We have the guys on the ground there. Slowly we build the contact and just repeat it in the other cities. So, you know, Melbourne is not the greatest years. So I think doing the whole thing in Brisbane would be great, yeah.
Yeah, awesome, man. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast, I'm sure, have warehouses without mezzanines. It's called Bow Racking, isn't it, your company?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, give Bow Racking a call, and I'm sure Tim will be able to help you out. Just tell him you heard him on the podcast, and I'll give you a 10% discount.
Sounds good. Let's go.
That's it.
But
man,
I can also give you a little downside in regards to mezzanines.
Okay, let's do it. Really downside. I like the downside.
Really not suitable for every business owner. If you want to put in high bay racking, if you want to have the whole space of a warehouse, it might not fit. The ratio is important. You can't overdo it. If you overdo it, it might be good for your value, but it also causes vacancy potential because it really doesn't fit for everyone anymore. That just happened to the property I described before. We've overdone it a little bit with the mezzanine and had a longer vacancy.
Yeah, because a warehouse generally is used for potentially high reach racking. You need clear span space. So if you put a warehouse or mezzanine in that airspace, then they can't actually use it for racking. And I worked in warehouses for the first 20 years of my life. So I know exactly what you're talking about. But yeah, I think that you need some mezzanine where it's suitable, but it does make you a lot more limited. But then again, like, some mezzanine does make it better for some businesses too. So it's a bit of a, like, just when you look at the property, you have to figure out what type of tenant you want to attract and do that. Or even go to your real estate agent, ask them who they have on their waiting list or what's the type of business they have on their waiting list, the most of them. And then you can kind of figure out, would they actually need that type of mezzanine? You could even ask them. You could even get them in your settlement, like, organized to be able to execute a lease on settlement of the property, so you have someone ready to rock and roll after the mezzanine is done.
Great advice.
Awesome.
What we should have done.
Well, there's always time. So in terms of, like, next, what's the real big goals here? Like, you got 10 properties. That's a good amount of properties. They're obviously smaller type assets, which this is really cool because a lot of people, and I'm actually also probably in the mindset is, like, I want to buy larger assets because I can add way more value to it. My self-storage in Wollongong, I can force $3 million of value onto that. It's one asset, right? 130 tenants, 3,000 square meters. It's a big asset, right? Doing it at a smaller scale is not always as easy because it's more difficult to find warehouses that are, one, vacant, because there's very low vacancy on warehouses right now, 1% and under in places across Australia. And then also that can actually have a mezzanine installed that would work for a tenant there. In terms of, like, size and stuff, what are your thoughts on actually buying bigger property? And it's just nice to see that you can add significant value to lower properties because you are literally proof of that.
Yeah, I think we would love to buy larger assets. It would be industrial as well. And maybe one of the strategies could be we chop it up into smaller units and do the mezzanine in each, you know, the office mezzanine, you know, so that would be a play we would be interested in.
Next. Yeah, awesome. So, mate, can you share, like, a challenge or, like, a particularly, like, difficult part of the journey where you've stumbled a bit, the finance could have been hard for one property, or you made a notable mistake?
Yeah, I mean, the finance is obviously getting, I feel like, a little bit more complex every time. And then also when you get to close to a serviceability, limit. They want to get more securities, and we definitely had a couple of hurdles there, and we have a kick-ass broker who helped us through there, you know. So touch wood, I think we had only one or two deals falling over just because we couldn't make it work. But most of the times, you know, he's pretty agile. Last minute, we need to move them to another lender, you know, but somehow it always works as part of it. It's exciting, very exciting.
That's cool. So like, how do you weigh up risk now? Yeah. Obviously, like at the start, you had your business that was going great, but you didn't have much real estate to risk. Now, obviously, you've got a larger portfolio. There's more at risk here. How do you weigh up the risk in your investments going forward?
Yeah. So we obviously need to keep an eye on what the portfolio is producing. So like we said before, if we keep pulling out equity, if we have 100% finance, obviously it's harder to be neutral or to be positive. The good thing with the portfolio is at the moment, it doesn't need to pay us because we have a construction company we live off, but it is more a value play. It's a long-term play. It's going to be hopefully producing something in the next 5 or 10 years. And just be a bit sensible. I think we want to keep adding, but then maybe a few cash flow years.
I tried to ask before, but what are the major goals? Like, do you have like, I want, you know, $50 million of real estate, or do you want to have like $500,000 to $1 million of like passive income per year between the two of you? What are the big hairy goals that no one likes to talk about, but I really enjoy hearing them?
We actually just had a catch up with our business coach and we talked about exactly that. And we want to get to $100 million in the next 5 years. Which is cool. Ridiculous. Maybe the number is not so important, but I think what's important is that we just have a little. Just go hard.
So you want $100 million real estate. That's awesome. That's a very good goal. I really like that. I'm shooting for my first goal is 100. Then I'm actually shooting for $1 billion.
There we go.
So that's a nice hairy goal for you. But
see this. So I think the number itself is probably not so important. I think it's more about going at it and really, really, reaching for the stars and just having a crack.
Yeah. Yeah, it really doesn't matter. Like, it's just the bigger the goal, if I do not get there and I get 500 million, like, I'm still stoked with that. Like, I'm stoked with 100 million, you know? So, like, what activity do I need to do and how many properties and what do I need? What employees do I need to have? How do I actually manage this? How do I need to evolve as a person, as an investor, to be able to create a $1 billion portfolio? That's the exciting part. The goal is just really arbitrary. It's just a number, but that would be fun.
Tell me more. And that will be in self-storage or?
Multiple assets. So like self-storage is the opportunity right now. But once I'm done with self-storage or I feel that the investment thesis is in like self-storage has run its course, then I'll move into manufactured home estates, which is more of a land lot. Like caravan park transitions to manufactured home estates where people are paying you a lot rent. You sell them the house on top and you make your development costs there. And then you also charge them a large lot rent every single month. And then when I'm older and I don't want to have so much work and like business side of it, then I'll transition into more passive type investments. Like, just straight up pure industrial with 5-10 year leases where it's literally like just set, put a tenant in there, forget. And then I can scale back when I want to, when I'm like 95 years old.
Sounds good. You got it mapped out. I love it. I love it. And, you know, Brandon would be proud of you.
Yeah, well, he's got a good syndication fund, Open Door Capital. So he's doing very, very well.
Is he still doing the RV part?
Yeah. So I still do, RV parks in America, because the thing is with those types of parks, and even in Australia, no one's really developing caravan parks, or even like it's very expensive to develop motels even. So you don't usually see a lot of those, whereas self-storage actually can be oversupplied. We're a while away from that, but it's easier to oversupply. So in terms of like the asset classes, you're not going to, if a caravan park is already in the location, there's no chance anyone's going to be putting another caravan park next to it and the council won't allow it. So there's a limited supply of those types of assets. And the deal flow for like caravan parks, motels is like infinite. Like there's just so many available. And it's really just managing the business better which makes the asset more valuable. So it's very, very easy if you put together the processes and it's just a rinse and repeat, like self-storage. So self-storage is just a business in a real estate asset. Now that I know and I can rinse and repeat with a self-storage facility, I can just keep on doing the same thing and same thing again. No new like headaches, except for actually the deal flow, which is more difficult. But I found that since interest rates have gone up, the deal flow of self-storage facility has also gone up as well. There's a lot more self-storage facilities for sale right now than there has been in the last 10 years.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, man.
So
very good.
What advice would you give someone who's considering transitioning into commercial real estate?
Just do it. So for me, I mean, I only have the one asset to compare to. I only have one residential property, but
yeah,
I mean, not that it matters, but it's definitely a lot more maintenance, always leaky taps, the fence falling over, the good stuff, and literally commercial. If you want to be a little bit more passive, you know, I mean, we have a kick-ass property manager, Aaron. So he is really, really hands-off. So I think just do it. And like you said, there, if you dream big, you should come into commercial.
Yeah, awesome, man. So using we interviewed Aaron Burdenshaw. Yeah, he's the top bloke, absolute top dude.
Amazing.
So, mate,
can
you share any like resources or like mentors that have really been invaluable to you? I know you just said you had a business coach. You know, tell me about like how you've got to this stage, because you've obviously got a good head on your shoulders. You understand. I can see that you've done a lot of research into the space. Can you share some resources that the listeners might not know about?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, I listened to your podcast, to every episode. At the start, it was very bumpy, but it got really, really good now. very good. It's great. Obviously, the stuff you did with Steve, the Commercial Property Explained series, unreal. You know, I've ever since I sent it to a couple of people, and it's just an amazing explanation how it all works, you know, step by step. So if you want to learn about commercial, I would probably start there. There are a couple more competitors. I don't know if you want me to name them, but there are a few really, really good podcasts out there.
Awesome, man. So in terms of like where people can go to contact you, where can they find your business? Where can they reach out to you?
Yeah, probably best on LinkedIn. Send me a message. I'm always happy to help. I mean, I have nothing to say, but I'm happy to give advice where I can.
And what's the website for the business?
Yeah, it's boracking.com.au.
And that's B-O-Racking.
Correct.
B-O-R-A-C-K-I-N-G. Fantastic, mate. Well, today has been super fun. My guest today has been Tim Hashke. Thanks, mate.
Thank you, Andrew.
Did I get it?
Pretty good.
Awesome. Thanks, buddy. That's good. That was fun. That's the end of another great show. I'd like to thank my guest today. And remember, in the words of Grant Cardone, be obsessed or be average. I'm Andrew Bean, signing off. This has been a Developer Life production.